Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
The Duke, his aged grandsire, bore the shame till he could bear no more. He rallied his declining powers, summoned the youth to Brackley Towers, and bitterly addressed him thus. "Sir, you have disappointed us. We had intended you to be the next Prime Minister but three. The stocks were sold, the press was squared, the middle class was quite prepared. But as it is, oh, my language fails. Go out and govern New South Wales." That was Hilaire Belloc, and that's the fate of Lord Lundy in one of his Belloc's cautionary tales, his poems published in 1907. And of course, governing New South Wales, which is the fate that awaits Lord Lundy, Tom, that's a fate worse than death for Edwardian Britain. Well,
especially being lined up to become Prime Minister.
Exactly.
Although by 1907, Australia had become federated. So Prime Ministers were being elected to run Australia.
Yes, we have been thinking a great deal about Australian prime ministers in the last few hours.
Speak for yourself. Days. Yeah. I've spent days on Australian prime ministers, prompted by the fact that by the time you listen to this, the Australian general election will have been held. Elections to the House of Representatives, which is, for British listeners, the equivalent of the House of Commons, and the Senate, which is the Australian equivalent of the House of Lords. You will know who has won. By this
attention,
I know,
excitement on the streets of Britain.
Whether it's the Liberals, who are confusingly for British listeners, basically the Tories or Conservatives under Scott Morrison, or Labour, which is Labour under Anthony Albanese. I think I've pronounced that right.
Yeah.
So you'll probably know, and I think Labour are mildly the favourites, aren't they?
They're marching ahead as at the time that we are recording this. They're just leading the opinion polls, aren't they? And the streets of Chipping Norton, Tom.
Talking of little else.
Yeah, little else, exactly.
Well, so this follows in the wake of episodes that we've done on German chancellors prompted by the German elections last year, and French presidents prompted by the French presidential elections. And what's interesting is that I would say that to the British, and Dominic, we're not apologising for being British, are we?
Never.
I mean, we are. We're being upfront about that to our many Australian listeners. That Australians seem like kin in so many ways. But we're much, politically much closer. We seem much closer to France and Germany. We have, you know, Merkel and Scholz and Macron are political figures in our consciousness in a way that, by and large, Australian prime ministers have not been.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Because everybody always thinks that we don't know enough about Europe and we're not sufficiently kind of plugged into Europe, and that all we care about is the Anglosphere and Anglo-Saxon carryings on. But actually, that's only true really of America. We don't, I mean, most of these names, I'll be completely honest, until we started thinking about doing this podcast and speaking to somebody who writes books about 20th century Britain, this is a terrible confession, but I hadn't heard of some of these Australian prime ministers. And it really reminds me of, so some listeners may remember that we had a guy called Andrew Preston. We've had him a couple of times on the show, professor at Cambridge, a Canadian, author of books about the Vietnam War and so on. And I can remember years ago him telling me that a Canadian prime minister had come to London. A former Canadian prime minister had come to the seminar, and Andrew was very excited and he'd gone to this seminar. And it was patently obvious to him that nobody knew who this man was, even when he introduced himself. And I said, "Oh, that's terrible. People are so ignorant. Who was he?" And Andrew said, "Well, he was Joe Clark." And I'd never heard of Joe Clark. I wouldn't have recognized him in a million. I still wouldn't recognize him if he walked down the street. And I think it's a very interesting lacuna in Britain's sort of political consciousness that the prime ministers or the politics more generally of our sort of Commonwealth, as you say, our Commonwealth kin, are completely unknown in this country.
So Australians, or indeed Canadians, listening to this may assume that this is kind of pommy snobbery and superiority, as evinced by the Hilaire Belloc with which we wittingly began this episode.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a much more favourable explanation for it, which is that it reflects incredibly well on the stability and the sanity of Australian politics. Because basically, you know, if your leaders are not intruding themselves on foreign consciousness, it generally implies that they're doing a good job. And I think that when you look at the evolution of Australia from, from its founding as a penal colony to the process where it becomes federated to now, it's an incredibly uplifting story, actually. I mean, it pains me as an English cricket fan to admit this. And I remember the first time I went to Australia, I so wanted to hate it. And I loved it so much. And it annoys me to have to admit that Australia is a much better run, seems a much happier,
well, Australians,
much saner country than Britain.
Australian listeners may find this bizarre, because, of course, their recent political history, they change prime minister about once every 18 months, and they're always stabbing each other in the back, as we will see when we get to the later stages. But it's true. I think a lot of the – if you look beneath the headlines, the story of Australia – of course, it does have dark chapters, but the political story of Australia in the 20th century and early 21st is actually, you know, compared with the stories of, I don't know, France, Germany, Britain, the United States, it's pretty untroubled, isn't it? I mean, there are scandals, there are things that go wrong, there are problems, but it's not, it's actually, as you say, it's a fairly sort of benevolent story. Of course, not completely benevolent, I know. But by comparison.
Yeah, so prime ministers lose their trousers. one of them drowns. So there are various kind of scrapes and escapades. But it's absolutely not on the level of the kind of traumas, say, that most European countries went through in the 20th century.
Exactly. So let's talk a bit, Tom, about, before we get into, because we're really going to focus on the post-war, on the wartime and then post-war prime ministers, aren't we? But we should say something, because Australian politics is terra incognita for so many of our British listeners, we should say something, shouldn't we, about the sort of the political culture, where it all comes from and so on. Because in some ways it's very British. And in some ways it isn't.
Well, so the one prime minister, that early prime minister that I know about, is actually the first prime minister. He's a guy called Edmund Barton.
Yeah.
And the reason that I know about him is because he was embroiled in a very early cricket scandal.
Right.
So in 1879, he umpired in a match that was notorious as the Great Sydney Riot. A match was being played at the ground that is now the Sydney Cricket Ground. And it was New South Wales against an English touring team led by an aristocrat, which just makes it perfect, you know, for the whole Pommy Aussie dynamic. So Lord Harris.
Yeah.
Yes. And the English were, you know, this was long ago. So back in those days, the English did well in Australia, and they were winning the match. And one of the two umpires gave out the best Australian batsman, Billy Murdoch. And there was a riot, and there was a pitch invasion. And people wondered, was this because they were trying to disrupt the match because gambling syndicates were behind it? Hmm. Or was it an expression of interstate rivalry because the umpire who'd given the New South Wales batsman out was from Victoria? Or what was going on? But Barton, as the other umpire, played a key role in diffusing the whole kind of bust-up.
What did he do?
Well, he essentially said that, you know, the umpire's ruling was final. He reminded everybody about their, you know, the essence of the, you know, the laws of cricket have to be upheld, fair play, all that kind of stuff. But he did it in a very sensitive way. So it won him friends all around. And I'm not saying that this is what enabled him to become first prime minister.
And the next thing he knew, he was prime minister. Yeah.
But I think it helped. And so he was very keen on Australia becoming a country. So he had this phrase, a nation for a continent for a nation.
Yes. So before that, Australia had been a series of colonies, hadn't it? New South Wales, Victoria, and so on, effectively administered by the Colonial Office.
Yeah.
And the pressure for I mean, we'll talk a little bit about some of the attributes of Australian political culture, but the pressure basically comes because they think they'll be stronger if they're if they're united in one federation. They say we have the same population now that the United States did when it became a nation. But also they're anxious, aren't they, about China.
And about yes.
That threat actually was really interesting researching this, how that perceived threat has run right through Australian political history from the late 19th century to the present. This sort of sense of living next door to this giant, which one day will awake.
So one of the reasons why federation is people in Australia vote in favour of the federation is that British strategists have warned that unless they do, Australia is likely to be invaded by China. So even then, there is kind of anxiety about this lurking, you know, this giant that's kind of
I can't help thinking that's that was pretty rich, given that actually that, you know, the Boxer Rebellion was happening in China and Western powers were piling in.
Well, hypocrisy is, of course, the great British quality. So that obviously is a theme. And obviously the relationship with Britain is a theme.
The Victorian era, my image of Australia was always, you know, it's basically there's Mr. Pecksniff. Is it Mr. Pecksniff? No, not Mr. Pecksniff. Who's the fellow who's always running out of money?
Mr. Micawber.
Mr. Micawber. There's Mr. Micawber. There's Magwitch. Yeah. There's assorted other variations on that theme. So basically impecunious people, convicts and so on, people building new lives, sheep farmers. But it's very British. But of course, there is a cleavage right there in Australian political culture that's there from the beginning to now. And it's between people who see themselves very much as the heirs of Britain and are more British than the British in some ways, and those who resent that. So particularly originally Irish.
Irish Catholic convicts. And so there's a religious dimension there as well, between Protestants and Catholics, between Anglos and Irish, between you know, people who could claim descent from the prison warders and people who could claim descent from the convicts. So I think that is a kind of tension that's always been
there. It's fascinating because that, I think, in itself is very British, because it mirrors what I think and what some other historians think is, you know, one of the great sort of unspoken cleavages in British political life, which is between the Church of England, people whose ancestors might have been in the Church of England, and those who are dissenters or Catholics or whatever, who'd be more likely to be drawn to non-Tory parties.
Yeah.
And I think you can definitely see elements of that culturally in Australian politics.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean, because I think the Liberal and Labour divide in Australia does map quite closely onto the Tory-Labour divide here in Britain.
Yeah. And once you start looking at their biographies and where they went, you know, what kind of schools they went to, what kind of household they were raised in, basically where they went to church of Australian prime ministers, you can often predict what party they'll be in.
Not always, as we'll find
no,
out.
No, not always. But, not
but,
always.
But
the other thing that I know, because I've got your notes in front of me, Tom, because of your extraordinary Australian enthusiasm, you've produced these colossal notes. Mateship. So the masculinity of Australian politics. That's really interesting, isn't it?
So the in the wake of the ball tampering scandal that afflicted the Australian cricket team a few years ago.
Who was the fellow who cried?
Steve Smith,
yes,
the Australian captain, when he resigned, there was a kind of, you know, we need new brooms, we're going to set things up, and the phrase that the Australian cricket team promoted was elite mateship.
Mateship, that's kind of the rubbish that you'd come out with.
Well, we obviously, everybody in our cricket team immediately said we've got to have elite mateship, but that idea of mateship, it's been argued by cultural historians of Australia, is reflective of the fact that Australia, to begin with, was a very tough environment.
So the frontier, particularly
if you're a convict, or you're on the chain gang, or if you were going out, if you're a gold prospector or whatever, it was tough. And so you needed to depend on one another. And so therefore, there is a much more egalitarian strain within Australian societal relationships and working environment than you would get, say, in Britain.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true, isn't it? I mean, there's also that sense of throwing off the hierarchies.
Yeah.
And the sort of stuffiness of the old world, isn't it?
Yeah. And so Australia is, you know, even in, even when Hilaire Belloc is writing that kind of sneery poem about the Lord going off to govern New South Wales, it's already, by today's standards, strikingly progressive. So votes for women.
Yes, of course.
I brought in 1902, and some states had that, you know, even before that. You've got free and compulsory education for all children is an idea that is very, very firmly held. So that, you know, in Victoria, that dates back to 1872. You've got old age pensions, invalidity pensions brought in 1908, minimum wage brought in 1907. And so all of this, I think, combines to give Australia an incredibly high standard of living, which, of course, in turn makes it appealing to people in Britain, perhaps, who...
Yeah. You know, Tom, if there was such a thing as the Australian Historical Tourist Board, they could not find a more enthusiastic advocate.
Well, except that there are downsides to this tradition of mateship.
Yeah.
One of which is that it's quite sexist.
Yeah.
So there's quite a sexist strain, I think, in, you know, not to say that there wasn't in Britain
well,
as well.
We will be coming to the premiership of Julia Gillard later in the podcast, won't we?
And also, I think it's led to a pretty overtly racist tradition for much of the 20th century, where Australian, you know, both on Labour as well as on the right, have been absolutely upfront about saying that Australia should be white. So they're kind of white only policy.
Well, it's a white Australia policy, wasn't it? Wasn't that what they called it?
Yeah, yeah. And so that's their right pretty much from the beginning. So in 1901, which is the year of Federation, you have the Immigration Restriction Act. And then this other one, this Quarantine Act, which basically, so you come in, you're coming from a country outside Europe, and you have to, if the immigration official says you've got to, you know, give me 50 words in a European language, and the immigration official can choose the European language.
That's ridiculous. So, that's laughable.
So, you know, you get people from Malaya or something being asked to give 50 words in Italian
or Portuguese
or something.
But any 50 words, can the officer choose the 50 words?
I think so. I mean, maybe Australian listeners could clarify if I've got that wrong, but I think that's the case. And so effectively it serves as a way of keeping non-Europeans out. And also, of course, it's expressive of this sense that that Asia in particular is pestiferous, that it's a breeding ground for disease. And that's quite a strong tradition that runs throughout certainly the first half of the 20th century in Australia and into the post-war years. So so that's perhaps an aspect that is less noble. And then, of course, there is the relationship of the white settlers with the indigenous people of Australia.
Yeah, the Aborigines, as many people would know.
So that also is, you know, how white Australia relates to them, whether they, you know, policies that are introduced to try and integrate Aborigines into white society, often attempts to do that generate further injustices, how the Australian government and society then respond to that. So that's another theme. So I think these are all...
Yeah. Well, obviously the confiscation of children is the most famous and controversial example, isn't it? So these themes are all running through the Irish versus English, egalitarianism, the mateship, the racism, all of this sort of stuff. So Tom, let's fast forward now. 1901 Federation, the event that many people will immediately think of as one of the building blocks of modern Australian, sort of a distinctive Australian identity, which is World War One and Gallipoli in particular. Yeah. So where do you think all that fits in?
Well, so Gallipoli is, you know, it's enshrined in Australian folklore as lions led by donkeys. And in this case, the donkeys are British and the lions are Australian.
You know, that's very unfair, actually, because more British and Irish died at Gallipoli than Australians.
I'm saying that's the sense that you have in Australia. So Steve Waugh, the most fearsome of all recent Australian cricket captains.
Steve Waugh?
Literally, well, W-A-U-G-H.
Yeah, I know his name. I know Steve Waugh is. I thought you were going to mention some, you know, top historian at the University of Melbourne or something.
Steve Waugh, when he brought the Australian team over, would take them to Gallipoli before coming to England to steal them for the fight. Stick it to the Poms. So that's a kind of downside. But I think it's important to say that the First World War did also cement Anglo-Australian relations. There was a feeling that it had been a shared sacrifice.
Yes.
So Billy Hughes, who was the Lloyd George of Australia, Prime Minister during the First World War, famously said that Australia is as much a part of England as Middlesex. So again, it's not, you know, there's this split, the tendency to regard Britain with suspicion, or the tendency to see that, you know, we're kind of kin.
Yes.
Going back. So you've got that. And then, of course, the other famous episode is Bodyline, where...
Oh, yeah. We talked about that in a previous podcast, didn't we? But for people who don't remember, that's the cricket tour in, was it 1930? You'll know, Tom.
Three, isn't it?
So Douglas Jardine is the captain. Larwood is the bowler. They're seen as dreadful British, destroying sporting play and all this kind of thing by bowling too hard at these poor, wilting Australian batsmen. That's about right, isn't it, Tom? That's a very fair description of
that. I think that's a very fair description. But also the other thing about it, of course, is that when the Australians complain to the English management about what's going on, namely that there's kind of physical intimidation with the cricket ball going on the cricket pitch, they're doing so in very English terms. They're saying, you know, this isn't cricket. This is not how you play the game. So again, there is that kind of tension. And that, of course, then takes us into the Second World War, which is the great dividing line.
It is the great dividing line, isn't it? So let's start with the Prime Minister who is most associated, I suppose, with the Second World War, certainly the beginning of the Second World War, and that is Robert Gordon Menzies. So he's from rural Victoria, isn't he? He's obsessed with cricket. Surprise, surprise. Am I right in thinking I see from the notes he's the first Prime Minister to have two Australian parents? So in other words, native-born Australians rather than immigrants.
Yeah.
But he's very British, isn't he? He loves the royal family and British traditions. And
British to the bootstraps was his famous self-description.
And his name, interestingly, so it's obviously a Scottish surname, which Scots will tell you is pronounced Mingus. And he would have told you that himself, I think, wouldn't he?
Yes, he did. And so one of his nicknames was Ming the Merciless.
Right. But everybody, because I watched a newsreel of him arriving in a Pathé newsreel of him making one of his trips to Britain during the Second World War. And he's very clearly Menzies.
Yes, so nobody picked up on that, but it was an affectation that he would have liked to see develop.
But there are two things about him that are notable as a young man, Tom. One of them, very disappointing for you, although he liked cricket, he was very bad at sport himself.
Well, feeling there.
So there's that. But then more importantly, his middle name, he is named after very much a friend of the rest is history. General Gordon. Is he really named after General Gordon, or is it just a coincidence?
Yeah, he is.
Are we just making that up?
No, he really was.
Well, that's splendid. He's a big fan of Aussie rules, which is obviously, because that's in Victoria, isn't it? Aussie rules. That's Melbourne.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he goes into he becomes a politician in the United Australia Party, which is the ancestor of the Liberal Party. And he just as well for him, he resigned just before the Second World War in protest at the lack of defence spending, which obviously is good for him. It means he's a bit of an Anthony Eden because he can then look like, you know, a sort of idol.
Yes, although he is hamstrung as a war leader because he had not volunteered for overseas service in the First World War.
That's right. And he said, people throw mud at me everywhere I go. I'm trudging through a trench of mud, he said, or something. Words to that effect.
Yeah.
A slightly ill-chosen image, you might think.
Yes. Yeah, not the most diplomatic. But that was because he was one of three brothers and the other two had gone.
Yes, that's right.
And so he got the long straw, I guess, on that.
Yeah, he did. So he becomes Prime Minister towards the end of 1939. He's very popular in Britain, isn't he? At one point, people are talking about him as a replacement for Churchill.
I think Menzies is himself.
Yeah, I think very implausibly. Very implausibly.
Yeah.
There are always these sort of claims that, some Commonwealth Prime Minister, because I think people sort of fantasize that Commonwealth Prime Minister would be untouched by the partisanship of the House of Commons.
Smuts was also often mentioned.
Smuts, exactly.
Yeah.
But he throws Australia wholeheartedly into the Second World War, doesn't he? And then for 2 years, so just before Pearl Harbor, he's kicked out for
I think what's interesting is and again this is a theme that runs particularly through the narrative of the Second World War, is that one of the reasons he goes to Britain is not just to maybe become Prime Minister of Britain, but also more germanely to try and ensure that the British High Command don't forget the Pacific Theatre, because they're twitchy about that.
About Japan, obviously.
About Japan. Kind of very, very kind of sensitive to it. So I think but I think there is also a kind of crucial thing that Menzies is very into the idea of the Anglosphere and the Commonwealth of English-speaking nations and all that kind of stuff. And there's a famous account of him going to Ottawa he's staying with the Governor General there, and he stays up late showing him his travel snaps.
Oh, that's nice.
And the Governor General's desperate to go to bed.
That's nice. That's like Churchill behaved very badly at the same time with Roosevelt, staying up late drinking his brandy and talking about great battles of history. So maybe Menzies and Churchill should just have cut out the middleman and stayed up late together.
Maybe they should have done. Anyway, so he's obviously away for quite a while, I mean, over a year. And by the time he gets back to Australia, essentially, you know, things have been happening there, and he gets politically assassinated.
He does, doesn't he? They don't want. He wants to go again. Doesn't he? Wants to go on another trip.
And, well, he wants to go back, I think, and try and become prime. The story is again that he wants to go back to become Prime Minister of Britain, and he needs the permission of Labour to do that. He won't countenance going into coalition with Labour, and so this is what ends up bringing him down.
Yeah, and what's he say? I've been done. I'll lie down and bleed a while.
Yeah.
Now, actually, I could have done that in an Australian accent, but it would have been wrong because I've listened to him talking, and he's not very Australian in his. He's quite British
to the bootstraps
in his speech. As actually, interestingly, FDR was. So, if you listen to FDR's addresses, he's much less American and more British. I mean, he was a very patrician figure in his intonation, and that's interesting that Australians at this point don't sound like Paul Hogan.
No. Well, so I think Menzies definitely not.
No, definitely not. So he they get rid of him, and Arthur Fadden. So Australia specializes in these interim caretaker prime ministers, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Who are almost always from some the country party or
no, I think he's. I think Arthur Fadden is the only prime minister from the country party.
Aren't they? What are the other? The others are from small parties often, though, aren't they?
No, I think
anyway, listen, we'll get into them. So Arthur Fadden, interesting fact about him is he was once part of a blackface minstrel troupe.
Yeah.
So he's the Justin Trudeau.
He's the Justin Trudeau of Australian politics. Yeah. Oh, it's so simple. I think we should take a break at this point. And when we come back, we should look at the great Australian war leader.
John, we've done one. We've done one prime minister in all this time. Well, shocking.
It's fine.
Even by our standards.
So let's come back. When we'll look at the great Australian war leader, John Curtin.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are talking about Australia's titanic political leaders. And Tom, we're about to get into a man who you just described as Australia's great war leader, John Curtin. And I'm going to guess that most of our British listeners will never have heard of John Curtin, which is a very good example, actually, of the way that Australian politics is occluded from the British imagination. Because,
well,
as you say, John Curtin is a massive figure in Australian history.
And in Civilization VI, if anyone's played that.
He's the leader of Australia, isn't he, yeah. Civilization? So, he's the face of Australia.
Yeah, against Genghis Khan or Augustus Caesar.
Well, I mean, yeah. But that speaks well of Australia, that they don't have a blood-soaked dictator.
It absolutely does, yes. Absolutely does. So he is, he's Labour.
Yes.
And so therefore, almost inevitably, his parents are from Ireland.
Yeah,
and
Cork,
he's Catholic.
County Cork. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Going very well, my in-laws.
Yeah.
And he's cross-eyed, which wouldn't. Not that they've got anything against cross-eyed people, but it's just they wouldn't be especially impressed, I think. Because didn't that sort of play a part in his, I don't know, self-image or something?
Yeah, I think he was very self-conscious about it.
Yes. But, Tom, I see in your notes you've written the dread words, solid batsman.
And he was absolute obsessive on cricket stats.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, if you're kind of having to work out logistics, it's probably good training.
It's interesting how cricket plays such a massive part in Australian life compared with in Britain, doesn't it?
It's the only national sport in Australia.
Well, you must look on this with a real sense of yearning, because
I do.
This would not be true of Ted Heath or Margaret Thatcher.
No.
Or, I mean, John Major, admittedly, yes, but not most of them. But most of these guys are absolutely obsessed with cricket.
I think, well, it's not just cricket. Also, I mean, all kinds of sport. I think sport has a really central role in Australia.
Yeah. Right. Let's talk about John Curtin.
Yeah.
So he's a trade unionist. And actually, he's very much on the left of the union movement as a young man, isn't he? He's practically a Marxist.
Pretty much a Marxist as a young man. Yeah. And he's anti-imperial. He's anti-war. So very much from that kind of tradition.
The Australian Marxist tradition. That's not one that you often
yeah,
hear
about. Yeah, but it is. You know, so... Actually, but Australia before, say, before the Russian Revolution is probably the most left-wing country.
Well, that's what's so interesting about Australia. This is precisely the thing, though. You don't hear a lot about the Australian Marxist tradition, but Australia, its political culture, which we would perceive, I think, as outsiders, as being very macho and all about barbecues and stuff, is actually clearly, to my mind, more left-wing than France's political culture, which is perceived in Britain as much more left-wing.
But it's a masculine left-wing culture.
Yeah, well, it is.
So
it is.
As we will explore.
So anyway, he voted against conscription in World War I, hadn't he? He'd moved to Perth in Western Australia, and he'd become more moderate in the interwar years, John Curtin. And he becomes... So he's the prime minister who basically has to deal with Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And with the effects of that. And with the colossal kind of Japanese... onslaught through Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And he makes this absolutely landmark declaration at the end of December 1941 that really probably you could argue is one of the two or three great turning points in Australia's entire history. Without any inhibitions of any kind, I make it quite clear that Australia looks to America free of any pangs as to our traditional links or kinship with the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
So, I mean... You know, it's right there, explicit. We're now looking to the Americans. And that's partly because he thinks the British have sold them out, is it?
Yes. I think he quite correctly recognises that for Britain, the focus is on defending the British Isles, British homeland. And that therefore, say, Singapore is not as strongly defended as it might be. Which is why the fall of Singapore, which follows in the wake of Pearl Harbor, is seen as such a, you know, it's so calamitous for Anglo-Australian relations, because it's a humiliation for Britain, but it's a kind of, you know, it's an existential crisis for Australians. And so the mud flinging over that is pretty bad. So the British,
because that's with Gallipoli, they sort of say, oh, the British officers are a load of feckless wasters who are
they're incompetent and useless,
and drinking gin and tonics.
Yeah, with their stupid straggly moustaches and their baggy shorts. Yes, exactly. That they're useless.
And the British have an absolutely splendidly scathing line about the Australians. I have to say, the Australians were known as daffodils, beautiful to look at, but yellow all through.
Yeah, I mean, that's not helpful, is it?
It's not very helpful for Anglo-Australian.
No. And also what's not helpful is that in the face of this disaster, Churchill pulls British troops and the Navy back to the two key kind of blocks of the empire, India and Australia. But again, he makes it perfectly clear that India is more important than Australia.
Yeah, the Australians are not happy, unsurprisingly, which is why they turn to the United States, and why I think you get from this point onwards... I mean, this is the sort of the thread that leads all the way through to Paul Keating in the 1990s, because he actually refers to this, doesn't he?
He does. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's still it's still a kind of itch to scratch in the 1990s. And it's you know, it becomes all the more kind of sensitive because Australia actually comes under attack. So the Japanese bomb Darwin.
Yeah.
In I think it's kind of early 1942. And then notoriously there's a Japanese submarine makes its way into Sydney Harbour and sinks a couple of ships. So Australians feel really, really vulnerable about this.
Yeah.
And you can see why they absolutely just go, okay, wait, you know, Britain's useless. Let's sign up to America.
Although interestingly, John Curtin himself never sort of disavows the link with Britain, because he says at one point about the White Australia policy that, you know, we are the descendants of people who came here to, quote, to establish in the South Seas an outpost of the British race. And he's absolutely unapologetic mm-hmm. about the.
Yeah,
about
I mean, I don't think there's a contradiction there. I think he feels that Britain, in a way, has betrayed a trust. Or perhaps is simply impotent to uphold that trust.
Yeah.
Whereas America is the face of the future, you know, vast numbers of course, of conscripts. So this is also an issue, is that Curtin is had originally made his name voting against conscription. And I think he increasingly comes to feel that as Australia fills up with American conscripts who are defending Australia, it's simply unconscionable for Australia not to have an element of conscription themselves. And so, he brings in a law that basically conscription is introduced and that they can be posted outside the limits of Australia if that involves defending Australia.
Well, he's clearly a man of iron principle, Tom, because he dies in July 1945, doesn't he? Just at the point the war is being won. And although he is of Irish Catholic parentage, he has turned his back on the Catholic Church and not just turned his back, he's stormed out and slammed the door very firmly shut.
Yeah,
because they bring him a Catholic priest, don't they, as he's dying, and he doesn't want to know him.
Go away, and mate.
Yeah, is that what he said?
Something like that, I imagine.
But what's extraordinary is he would never set foot in a Catholic church, not even when his friends were getting married. He wouldn't go.
That's a very Catholic form.
It's very Catholic
Catholicism,
behavior,
isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it is. So, it is.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah, I think you're still.
So anyway,
Catholic there.
He is succeeded by a man who, now this is a confession, you know, some people will think absolutely damning that he, a man who I learn from online historical rankings of Australian prime ministers of Australia.
And from research in the Bodleian.
Historians and political scientists. I learn by people in the know is regarded as one of Australia's absolute greatest prime ministers. And until about 4 hours ago, I don't think I'd ever heard of him.
But Dominic, that is, it's so interesting because of course he is in a way, he's the Clement Attlee.
He is.
Of Australia.
We should tell people who he is because they won't know.
Okay, so this is Ben Chifley.
Ben Chifley, a name to conjure with.
Who, again, very like Curtin, is of Irish descent.
Yeah, he's from New South Wales, isn't he?
He's a Labour Party and he is an engine driver. And again, I just think it reflects tremendously well on Australia that, you know, an engine driver can...
We had engine drivers in Britain. Jimmy Thomas in the 1930s.
Yeah, they didn't become Prime Minister.
No, he didn't.
Our prime ministers went to Eton.
Engine driver. They did.
So it's on that he gets involved in the unions, and unions are very, very strong in Australia.
Yeah.
He kind of enters. He's through the 30s. He's early 30s. He's Minister of Defence, and he loses his seat. Has a really bad Great Depression. At one point, you know, he's dependent on his wife's earnings. So has it really bad. 1940 gets back into Parliament. By the following year, he's become the treasurer, so Chancellor of the Exchequer equivalent, finance minister for Curtin, and succeeds Curtin. And as I say, is basically the Clement Attlee of Australia.
Well, he's very much about sort of fiscal discipline, controls. He's a sort of financial wizard, isn't he, running the Australian economy. But he's also got the austerity of an Attlee, and he's got that very mid-century sort of Labour Party tradition, but austere, patriotic kind of man.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing that sums him up is this thing he's about being his dinner with the King, George VI.
Yeah.
So the King invites him to dinner, doesn't he, Tom? And he can't go because he's got no evening dress. But what happens?
The King says that he'll wear a lounge suit. And so Chifley and the King go, and nobody else knows this. So the King and Chifley are the only two in lounge suits.
I think that's a story that reflects absolutely splendidly on George VI.
Yes. That's the embodiment.
Colin Firth would love that story.
I know. Why didn't they put that in?
They should have put that in the... Geoffrey Rush could have played Chifley as well, being Australian. So he loses Tom in 1949, very similar to Attlee's loss, I suppose, in 1951.
Well, he wanted to nationalise the banks.
And that was a step too far.
Yes. And by this point, Robert Menzies is back at the head of, you know, the conservative, the right.
The Liberal Party, yeah.
Well, I don't think it is quite the Liberal Party yet. No, because it's all rather confusing.
Or it's sort of
becoming still the United Australia Party.
Yeah, it's becoming the Liberal Party.
And so he does the kind of anti-communism stuff. He plays that very hard. And so Chifley loses the election. And he's dead within a couple of years.
So he dies, Tom, during the dinner that they're having to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Federation of Australia.
Yeah.
And Menzies announces, his rival announces his death.
In very moving terms.
He says, I've printed it out. Very exciting. I won't do it. And I don't have to do an Australian accent because Menzies didn't have a very Australian accent. He said, it's my very sorrowful duty during this celebration tonight, tiny bit of one, to tell you that Mr. Chifley has died. I don't want to try to talk about him now because although we're political opponents, he was a friend of mine and of yours and a fine Australian.
A mate. All
So that's sort of mateship, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we're all kind of great Australians together. And I think that's actually one of the nice things about Australian politics is they love being Australian.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's always saying how great it is to be Australian deep down. We're all Australians. Anyway, so that's the end of Chifley. He's dead. He's gone to top spot.
He might have had an affair with his secretary.
Well, she was with him in the hotel.
Phyllis.
And one of his biographers later said that he might have had an affair with her sister as well.
I know.
Everybody's family denied that very vociferously, don't they? So people who've listened to our previous podcasts about sort of presidents and so on, chancellors. So the German one was notable for the behavior of Gerhard Schroeder, and the French one for the bad behavior of all of them. But the Australian one is such bad behavior as there is, and there will be some bad behavior to come. It's much more.
It's
small scale. There's no eating of precious birds or Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. He wouldn't stand a chance.
Well, oddly,
Australian
You tend to think of Australia as a particularly religious country, but the
they all were from church-going.
Yeah, that was
very keen.
And when they're not church-going, they're kind of priggish. They're priggishly not church-going.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that must be.
They're either people of faith or they're people who very, very vigorously abjured their faith, aren't they?
Yes, and so essentially are still people of faith.
Yes. So anyway, Menzies has come back. And Menzies, what I found absolutely fascinating about Menzies is Menzies comes back. And in 1942, he'd given a speech about the forgotten people. Did you see this, Tom?
No.
So he said in this speech, I do not believe that the real life of this nation is to be found either in great luxury hotels and the petty gossip of so-called fashionable suburbs or in the officialdom of the organized masses. It is to be found in the homes of people who are nameless and unadvertised and who, whatever their individual religious conviction or dogma, see in their children their greatest contribution to the immortality of their race. And this struck this was his great speech on the sort of forgotten Australians. And it struck a massive chord with kind of suburban, I guess, middle-class voters. And this is, almost 30 years before Richard Nixon gives his silent majority speech, that coins the phrase the silent majority. And Menzies is doing it in the 1940s, this classic kind of centre-right appeal.
Well, so again, I think this is a theme that will quicken in the post-war years. The way in which actually Australia kind of blazes trails for both British and American politics.
Yeah.
And you see this happening again and again and again. It's almost like it's a kind of American and British politicians look at it as a kind of laboratory where things are being tested out.
I completely agree.
And that's a kind of, you know, an intriguing
example. Because it's a, you know, it's a very suburban society, Australia, isn't it? Becoming a very suburban society in the mid-century, in sort of 50s, 60s. And it's sort of anticipating the suburban politics that you'll see, let's say, Margaret Thatcher, that she does with her appeal to kind of home ownership and stuff.
Yeah, and I think that rather like, you know, hippies see Nixon as the embodiment of everything that they hate, you know, oppressive, stuffy, parochial. Young intellectuals in Australia see Menzies in similar way.
Yeah.
So, and that's why, you know, all the kind of the big names who come to England, so Clive James and Jermaine Greer and Barry Humphreys, essentially what they're fleeing is Menzies.
Yeah.
And everything that he embodies. Yeah. The irony being, of course, is that, you know, they're fleeing the Anglophile Menzies to come to London.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they're fleeing the sort of the Australian affluent society to some extent, aren't they? Kind of complacent, conservative, affluent society.
Yeah, and a kind of censoriousness. So there was a kind of famous case where a cafe named the Moulin Rouge in Sydney was fined for having on the cafe wall a copy of Toulouse-Lautrec's Woman Adjusting Her Stocking. And this was condemned as obscene.
That's brilliant.
So, I mean, that's why Jermaine Greer would obviously, you know, put up with that.
But that's sort of, so famously, Jean Shrimpton was said to have pioneered the miniskirt. I think that's actually an exaggeration. At Melbourne, a Melbourne racecourse, and the matrons of Melbourne were horrified that she had a mini dress, I think it actually was, that went above her, that stopped at the knee, and you could see the bottom of her legs. Goodness. So there is a sort of conservatism. I mean, as well as it's egalitarian and it has very strong trade unions and a welfare state, there is a kind of moral conservatism.
Yes, and I think the strength of that left-wing tradition is what makes the anti-Marxist tradition correspondingly strong. And that's what Menzies plugs into, and he's always invoking it. And so there's a famous... So he's up for re-election in 1954, and... what crash lands into the course of that election, which it looks like Menzies is going to lose, is probably Australia's most famous spy scandal, the Petrov affair.
It's a great affair, this. If you're going to have a spy scandal, this is
yes.
the one.
So Petrov, he was Vladimir Petrov. He was a KGB officer, and he's hanging out in Sydney. And he decides that, you know, Australia's a lot nicer than Moscow.
Yeah. And why so didn't they all defect?
He decides to jump ship. So he says, I no longer believe in communism since I have seen the Australian way of living. But he doesn't tell his wife. And once he's defected, the kind of Soviet goons bundle her onto a plane in the full view of Australian cameras. And they're all appalled by this. And this plane has to refuel at Darwin. And Australian Secret Service agents managed to get her off the plane. And obviously this is, you know, damsel in distress, evil communists. Yeah. It's brilliant. And it enables Menzies to overcome the odds and to win the election. And so there's been this grumbling conspiracy theory that Menzies timed the announcement of Petrov's defection to sway the election. And
maybe he did. I mean,
well, I who knows? But
he'd be a fool if he didn't.
I gather from my extensive research into this, the consensus is that it wasn't Menzies who did this, but it's possible that the Australian Secret Service ensured that the timing would be right.
The big question, though, Tom, is what did Vladimir Petrov think? I mean, he might not have told his wife. I know a lot of people are thinking he didn't tell his wife because he couldn't afford that she would tell somebody or she would persuade him out of it or didn't want to implicate her. But, I mean, he might have been gutted when the Australians pitched up and said, we've got your wife, mate.
Yeah, he might well have been. I don't know. Again, if there are experts in the Petrov affair who can tell us how Petrov and his wife got on after the defection, I'd be very interested to know about that. But basically, this has quite a knock-on effect because essentially it bakes in anti-communism as a key part of Menzies' appeal to the people who voted for him. And so therefore, he's very, very keen to play the anti-communist card. And with Vietnam starting to kind of bubble up to the north of Australia, this is why Menzies essentially signs Australia up to the Vietnam War. And in fact, he's so keen to do it that he fabricates an invitation from the South Vietnamese government asking for Australian troops. They never did this.
The Australians, if you believe in the domino theory, which so many people did in the 1950s and 60s, which is that one state after another would fall to communism. And as one went, then its neighbour would be the next in line. I mean, the last dominoes are Australia and New Zealand. And there must have been an awful lot. There were people in Australia who were extremely anxious that as they look to their kind of northwest, that the tide of communism, especially if they, as you said at the beginning, if they're already believing that they're living next door to this sort of this great, this sort of pestilential, disease-ridden pit, as they see.
So I'm sure that's a part of it as well. And I'm sure also it's about, it's following on from Curtin's declaration that they're now going to look to the United States, that Australia is now playing the role to the United States that it had previously played to Britain of mateship.
Yes.
Geopolitical mateship. Yes. Signing up to help. Well, so Menzies gets Australia into the Vietnam War. He is the guy who starts the dismantling of the White Australia policy.
So he starts immigration reform.
Yeah. And he's, I think he's a pretty principled man. He's very intellectually able. He's not greedy. He's a kind of personally,
he's an upstanding Australian.
Yeah, he's an upstanding Australian.
But I mean, if you're an Australian, if you're Germaine Greer or whatever,
he's everything you'd hate.
You absolutely despise him.
He's everything you'd hate. And I think he does have a slightly comical strain of Anglophile vanity. So when he steps down in 1966, he succeeds Churchill as warden of the Cinque Ports. Which people who've listened to the episode we did with Alex Preston on
smuggling.
This is a kind of medieval consortium of ports in the southeast of England.
He's leading the fight against smugglers, is he?
Yes, he is. And there's a tremendous uniform, that involves comical hats and
like Rex Hunt.
And things.
Very Rex Hunt.
And I get the impression that Menzies is never happier than when he's dressed up as in his Warden of the Cinque Ports.
Well, he sort of bows out. One of his last great sort of public appearances, Tom, could not be more, Anglo-Australian relations, could it? So it's 1977. Yep. The centenary test
in the MCG, yeah.
And he's knighted by the Queen in the long room of the MCG, which is the Melbourne Cricket Ground.
Yeah. What a way to get a knighthood.
You must look on that with absolute envy.
I really do. And he loved old cricket grounds. So he's the guy who described Lord's as the cathedral of cricket. So in so many ways,
he's the man you wanted to be.
Secretly.
Yeah.
Secretly. I'd love to be Warden of the Cinque Ports and be knighted by the Queen in a cricket pavilion.
So listen, we've fallen quite short of where we're intending to get to with this first podcast, because we've only got to 1966. But that's fine, because we've got a lot of
Aussie Prime Ministers to come.
Yeah. And they're all good fun. So I think we will adjourn now for tea, as it were.
Yes.
And we will return. Tom, Harold Holt will be opening the batting.
Yes,
he gets a swimming analogy for Harold.
Yes. So Harold Holt will open the innings tomorrow, and I have to say, gets dismissed quite quickly and in very, very controversial circumstances, frankly, quite extraordinary memorial. But if you want to find out more about that, tune in tomorrow. Good day.
Good day.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.